I want to welcome to upcoming discs, Daniel Cross, the director and writer of the documentary I Am the Blues. Welcome to upcoming discs, Daniel. How are you?
Great, thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, I did get a chance to see your documentary. I'm a musician myself, so I certainly appreciated the kind of closeness you got to these guys and how much you really, really got into the soul of the music that they do. And I guess I have to ask you first, did you have much connection to the blues? Were you a blues fan before you went on this journey, or is this something that you just decided to embark on first?
No, I was a hardcore blues fan and had the opportunity not of meeting those specific blues musicians that are in the film, but previously having the opportunities of spending some time with different, some of the original dudes back in the day, and just realize when it seemed like this was the last of that kind of generation that was connected to the roots of the blues, cotton fields, sharecropping and stuff, that I really wanted to get out there and capture some of their spirit and some of their stories and let them joke around.
Sure. So how did you get to find these people? How did you track them down, and how did you kind of get involved with?
Yeah, so that in that situation, I was super fortunate. We have a thing like South by Southwest here in Montreal, because I'm from Canada.
Yeah.
And there's a guy named Dr. Ike, Ira Padnos is his name, out of New Orleans, and he runs the Ponderosa Stomp, which is a foundation, and it's the first weekend of every October in New Orleans. And over the last couple of decades, they kind of go out and reignite some of the old classic musicians who have, you know, lost their popularity, and bring them back on stage and do like a retrospective homage to them. And so he brought a review, a traveling review to Pop Montreal of old blues musicians, and there was Lazy Lester and Barbara Lynn, Little Buck, and some of the characters that actually are in the film. And when I saw that, I went, oh, this is just like what I envisioned. So I spoke to him, and he said, you know, because he's actually a surgeon at the New Orleans Trauma Center. He goes, you know, in July I have a lot of time off, so if you come in July, I'll pick you up and I'll take you around. And so we jumped in his car, and he took me from New Orleans right through to Memphis, and we stopped at like 20 or 30 old-timers' houses along the way, including Bobby Rush and the Blue Front Cafe, and I just got to meet all these people. And then from there, I went back a second time to try to figure out who was really ready to participate, who had the energy and the musical chops still to lay it down. So I owe a lot to Dr. Ike.
Yeah, so that's how you got introduced. But one of the things that have to be a skill that you just have as a filmmaker, as a documentarian, is that you manage to get some of these guys to be kind of easy around you and not like they're in front of a camera. You manage to get them to tell stories and to act around you sort of like they might if the camera hadn't been there. How do you achieve something like that?
Well, time. You have to spend time with them to gain their trust and for them to relax. And a lot of that process is not focused on getting footage, but gaining a respect and a camaraderie together. And also that's my way of doing things. So it's comfortable for me to kind of lay low and encourage natural activity and try to emphasize on spontaneity and fun. They're natural characters, right?
So yeah.
That's the other thing, because they are show people.
Yeah, they really are. But, you know, because they're show people, I was more amazed at how non-aware of the camera and unaware of the fact that they're going to be in a film they were. And that seems to me to even be harder for show business people, because I know those people, and I'm one of them sometimes, and we tend to like to mug for the, you know, for the publicity. But they don't in this film. There's no mugging. They're really genuine.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I did make clear, and that might have got some of their gained some of their confidence, is I told them, like, I don't want to deal with managers, I don't want to film big shows with you and your, like, outfits and shtick.
Right.
I'm not going to talk to other people about you. I'm only going to focus on you in that kind of first-person lived experience. So, you know, it's the film is about, you know, you you and how you are in your world and with your friends. So we just kind of got at it.
Well, and you managed to capture the music. There's plenty of wonderful sort of almost impromptu performances. There's plenty of stories told and such. And I guess I wanted to ask you, what was the hardest for you to capture? Was it the stories or was it the music?
No, I would say technically it's the music, because you got to be there and ready to do a good job.
Right.
Because, you know, especially when you're getting spontaneous things like on their front porch, how things are mic'd so that they have the opportunity to be spontaneous and not
right.
be surrounded by microphones and stuff. That was tricky, and I think we got very fortunate with good quality sound. But the stories are actually harder, because the music just comes so natural to them, and in some ways the music is, you know, protects the vulnerable side of them.
Right.
You know, so they, when in doubt, just kick into a song and everyone's going to be happy, because obviously they're the best musician in the crowd.
Exactly.
And to get those, and they've lived through, you know, they've lived through hell.
Sure.
And all the, you know, the segregation and everything else that's gone on over the last 80 years. So, you know, they are vulnerable. So getting them to slow down a bit, expose and open up was definitely harder.
Yeah, and there is to a certain extension of who they are and how they speak. I was taken by one of the gentlemen said that his guitar was the Bible. And to me, that really summed up a lot about what these guys feel, that is their life. That's almost their worship.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think becoming a musician of that quality, let's say back in the 50s, 40s and 50s, when they would have been in their 20s.
Right.
And how that tool, that instrument, you know, protected them and cared for them and enabled them to find work, and even, you know, enabled them to stay out of the fields.
Yeah.
And do what would, you know, hardcore toil for no money. I think, you know, they pretty much owe the quality of their life to their music.
For many of them, it's how they escaped the ugly, you know, world that they were living in at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true.
Well, and the other thing that we're talking about here, too, so the audience understands, we're talking about people who are 70, 80, and maybe even older than that. Incredible chops. I love the cinematography where you show the close-ups of these old, withered hands and how they can still move across a piano or still move across a keyboard. That must have been an important point for you to make, that this is a dying breed and that these guys still have incredible chops at 80. I hope I can play guitar like that at 80.
I mean, it's so exciting when we're hanging out with Henry Gray at the piano, and he's 92 years old, and he played for, I think, 18 years with Howlin' Wolf, and he just decides to lay it down. And I mean, like, it's just like goosebumps watching it happen. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And, you know, and then they hang out, and the way they really communicate back and forth to each other is by trying to out-duel each other
physically. Right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, he lays it down, and then Lazy Lester is, like, cutting him off.
Yeah.
Singing louder than Carol Fran, who's, like, giving him a smack in the head to shut up.
Exactly. Telling him he's not the only one there.
Yeah, and we were lucky to have such help by Bobby Rush. Bobby Rush really took to the film and escorted me to a lot of places and helped tie the whole film together. So
yeah.
There's what I would like to say, a third act. You know, it's not just a series of vignettes, but an actual narrative that's kind of unfolding.
Yeah.
He was very generous with his time and help on the film.
Yeah. And Bobby,
and being more popular, the other musicians resonated when Bobby came, because it was it was kind of like, oh, Bobby Rush, he's a star.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, and he certainly represented the more polished, almost more mainstream part of the blues that we experienced here. He certainly was the professional in the group.
Absolutely. He's always working. That's a guy that is always kind of on, like when you're talking about that style.
You could see that,
persona, yeah. You know, like he's always working. He's always thinking about what he's doing and where is it leading to.
Sure.
But just having him around was definitely helped wrangle the other people.
Well, I'll tell you something that's a little sad is that it you introduce us to people who actually had bona fide hits, you know, some time ago. And to see how they're living now, it's like, it's almost unfair.
It's true. I mean, Barbara Lynn was big all-time number one hit maker, you know, the original
exactly.
female guitar slinger. And, you know, I would say after, when she got into about her 40s, she basically took a big step to the side and decided all that wasn't really worth it. And she wasn't really, you know, advancing respectfully.
Right.
And she still plays. I mean, they still all play and they still go do gigs and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. they're definitely not, you know, they're not on a main big arena or
right.
anything like that.
And, you know, and continue on the fact that we're talking about 70, 80, 90-year-olds, the fact is some of the people who are in the film are already gone, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's true. Well, Bud Spires, Benjamin Bud Spires, the harmonica player that used
yeah.
to play with Jack Owens out of the Bentonia School of Music, mm-hmm. passed while we were making the film. There's, like, the website is full of other characters and other clips because we filmed about 50 different musicians.
Yeah.
So the first musician we actually filmed was Alain Toussaint. And mm-hmm. his baby grand piano.
Yeah.
And not long after we filmed him, he passed away. We went out to Memphis, and we filmed Teeny Hodges from the high rhythm section that plays with Al Green.
Right.
And he passed away not long after that. And we lost Elsie Elmer, who's one of the stars in the film.
Yeah.
He passed away at 86. And a few others, Guitar Gable and Jockey Etienne, both out of Lafayette, have passed on. And at that age, you know,
right.
it's inevitable that this is going to happen. For many of those people, this is the last recordings, I'm pretty sure, of them. So I have to archive all the footage on a rainy day.
And that brings me to what I, at least for me, the big takeaway from the documentary is that there's a danger of this completely disappearing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the firsthand experience that these cats have to the blues.
Yeah.
Passes with their generation because sharecropping stops and these elements of first-hand lived segregation and, you know, close to slavery
mm-hmm.
that are, you know, very relevant to the experience of the, you know, rural country blues.
Yes.
You know, you can't just make that stuff up. So it's still the blues, it's just different experiences inspiring the music.
Do you see any hope of it continuing?
Well, yeah, you know, as Bobby Rush and Jimmy Duck Holmes say at near the beginning of the film at the Blue Front, that even when they're talking about the guys that do hip-hop and rap,
right.
and they go, you know, that's the blues. They talk about, you know, their experiences and how it impacts on their lives and how are they going to get through things. And that's basically the blues.
Yeah.
Elsie Elmer points out that Jimmy Reed is singing that, you know, he wore his 44 so low it made his shoulders sore.
Right.
That's basically gangster rap, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, blues music, I think, is always going to be present in music.
And it's something that, yes, the recordings will exist, and you preserved some of it here, but it's something that I think you almost have to experience. In fact, the thing I was going to ask you that I was most interested in is that there have to have been moments that you recorded, that you filmed, that as you looked at them, you realized you just can't capture what it was like to be there. There's just something's missing.
Oh,
can
yes.
you think of a moment in particular
Absolutely.
That you just felt like, man, this just doesn't go anywhere near what it was like?
Well, some of that happens with R.L. Boyce, because R.L. Boyce is really active. Like, he's always outdoors, and he's always going from place to place.
Yeah.
And so, like, we go to the for Turner family picnic. You know, him and Napoleon Strickland are the founders of the fife and drum type
yeah.
music. And his grandkids are doing, like, a fife and drum march.
Wow.
And I'm, like, filming this. And, wow. And, like, on film, it just doesn't do any justice at all.
No, I imagine that it won't.
We just left it out because it was also a little bit different than most of the stuff that we were covering.
Yeah.
So it required a bit of, you know, because basically, you know, you do different scenes and it starts to sensitize the audience and slowly you get washed over and you start feeling where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Through the time and the space and the editing, and you absorb more and more as the film goes on because you get sensitized.
Right.
So then when you throw in something that's completely awesome but comes out of the blue, it can look a bit like a caricature
yeah.
or a cartoon.
Well, it seems to me like it would be an honor to have even been in these guys' presence and hard to even almost imagine the stories they're telling and the lives they're talking about, and then you listen to it, the music, and that explains it more than sometimes the stories.
Yeah, yeah, and being able to watch them play.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're playing for each other, so they're watching each other play and reacting like they're getting smiles from Bobby Rush, as Elsie Elmer's kind of doing that guitar move at the blue front, and you see a smile goes on his face, and you can just sense kind of the influences and time passing and kind of the warmth they feel for each other.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, some of the best moments are, for people who get the DVD, I highly recommend it, because there are a piece of footage that you didn't put into the original one. My particular favorite is the guy who talks about his wife that stabs him and shoots him five times, and they stay married for 30 years.
Little Freddie King, he got shot by his wife five times and then stabbed in the leg. Yeah.
And they remain married for like 30-some years. That's the part that gets me.
Yeah. It's just unique, isn't it? You can't make that stuff up. Well, that's the thing. The DVD has a lot of extras. Absolutely.
And they are definitely worth exploring. And I also was particularly happy with part of towards the end, where you have the Reverend talking about how some of these guys had to deal with the fact that as they were playing the blues, the church was considering it as devil music. But the fact is that they both have the same roots. And I like how he goes into that and explains that. And that's a wonderful element as well.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's Reverend Wilkins. And
yes.
Father Robert Wilkins is one of the kings of blues.
Right.
And wrote The Prodigal Son, which like every Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and everybody covered.
Yeah.
And then went into the ministry and started rewriting his music with slight shifts and changing some of the lyrics and performing it as gospel music.
So do you plan on doing any follow-up to this, or maybe even with the footage you have, giving us more down the road?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to make more of the footage available. I feel accountable to do that, because, as we were saying, a lot of them have passed on, and so these are kind of have archival aspects to them now.
Yeah.
And talking with Dr. Reich about what we might be able to do to follow up, together with the Ponderosa Stomp, on perhaps another film or a series of short kind of maybe biographies of some of these musicians.
That would be a great idea. And you mentioned a website. Go ahead and plug it here, and we'll also add a link to the interview so people can go there and explore this. So why don't you go ahead and give us that?
Okay, so iamthebluesmovie.com. And on the site, you have the full listings of where it's playing, because it's still playing theatrically across the states.
Okay.
And it has the links to where you can get the DVD and all the other extras.
Mm-hmm.
And if you click on the thing called About the Film, there's like 11 posters. There's a poster for each of the characters that are all downloadable. You can
print
them. There's photos. There's bios. There's lots of material on there for people that are really into it.
When you started this project, did you expect that it would turn into almost a responsibility to try to preserve something?
No, I had no idea. I felt like I didn't necessarily feel I had the right for them to pay attention to me. I'm a white guy from Canada coming down to the deep south, trying to convince people that I'm going to, document them and help put their story out there.
Right.
I don't think without Dr. Ike's help that it would have necessarily been as easy as it was.
Mm-hmm.
They were very gracious. Everybody was, it changed my life getting to know these people. It's changed my perspective on, humanity. They're so positive, and they have such a joie de vivre. And they're very, very, very gracious people.
Yeah.
And they've lived through hard times, and yet they keep that respect about them and pride that is inspirational.
And you've done a lot of documentaries. Has any of those documentaries touched you like this one?
I one time I made a film where I spent 10 years on the streets in Montreal filming a series of elderly homeless people when I was a lot younger, and that was pretty emotional.
Yeah.
But it's been a long time since I've been as touched as I have making this film.
Well, and anybody who watches the DVD will be touched as well. It's an experience. It particularly true for me as a musician. We have a nice blues place here in Tampa. I'm in the south as well, and we have a place called Skipper Smokehouse here, which is it's one of the best blues places in the state. And so I got to see people like Johnny Hooker. Was an experience that I'll treasure for the rest of my life. Hopefully people will
Hooking
see
with
this.
The hook.
Yeah. hopefully people will see this and they'll get to understand it a little more deeply, and they'll get to sample something that just may not be around much longer for us to sample. And thanks to you for doing that and for the time it took for you to come and talk to us about it.
Well, I'm so happy that I got to talk to you and that you like the film and that you're enjoying it.
I did enjoy it. And
Thank you. It
touched me as a musician and as a person, and I highly recommend it. So I hope to see more of it. I will be following as much as I'm sure our audience will to see more of this footage and to see more of what you do with it.
Well, it's not right where you are, but this week it opens in Tallahassee, Florida. So maybe it'll come your way on
yeah.
the screen, which is a lot of fun.
Well, let us know. If it comes to Tampa, let us know. It'd be something we'd love to cover.
Great, I will.
All right. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for preserving these moments in history. And again, I just look forward to more.
My pleasure. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Same here. You take care.
Okay. All right, you have a great day.
You too.